Media recognition from Bloomberg, Reuters, Recycling Trade Publications. Patented process for 100% recovery of critical metals, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, aluminum. American Manganese is focused on recycling lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles. American Manganese trades on the TSX Venture, AMY, the U.S., AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit AmericanManganeseInc.com or phone me, Larry Ray, at 778-574-4444.
Welcome to the Goddard Report. Comments made on the Goddard Report and TalkDigitalNetwork.com are an expression of opinion only. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Dr. Stephen Malthouse, MD. He's president of the Canadian Health Alliance online at CanadaHealthAlliance.org. He's speaking to us from Denman Island, British Columbia. Stephen, welcome back to the Goddard Report.
Oh, thank you, Jim. It's a pleasure to be here.
Stephen, can you first tell us about the Canada Health Alliance and what is attracting more and more people to it?
Well, the Canada Health Alliance is an association which has been in existence for more than a year now, and it's really was created to put together a network of all the healthcare professionals across the country, whether you're a doctor, a nurse, a chiropractor, a dentist, and to try to, but through that network, try to solve some problems we're currently seeing in our healthcare in the country, as well as look to the future. What kind of healthcare would we really like? And many of us are witnessing the sort of disintegration of the current system. And we want to make sure that when there's a void there, when people are looking for doctors, which, you know, so many people don't have doctors in just British Columbia alone, family doctors, that we'll have some system to put in place there that people will be able to go to. So we're certainly looking for a more integrative medicine approach, and also I think we're trying to bring the patient back into the center of things, and with that comes responsibility for one's own health too, which seems to be kind of lacking nowadays.
You've been on a speaking tour of BC. What can you tell us about it?
Yeah, well, the Canada Health Alliance, we started off a tour called Doctors on Tour, Educate Before You Vaccinate. And the reason we did this, it was a tour where it's actually three parts. We went throughout British Columbia. We went to about 30 different towns, cities, and spoke to people there. We had, you know, lots of people come out to hear us speak, usually two or three doctors at a time. Sometimes we had five. And the purpose of it was that when we saw the COVID shots being rolled out for the, you know, five-year-old on up, we realized that, you know, this, we needed to get out into the community and speak to people face-to-face and let them know what was going on, but also give them the information they needed, the medical information, the research, that would allow them to make informed decisions for their kids. And we found there was a big gap. People weren't getting the information they needed to know to make wise decisions. And so they were just kind of running on, you know, maybe what they'd heard on the TV. That was not good enough for us. And of course, children, you know, between, you know, five and 11, they don't need the shots. And actually, you know, they've only got in 2020, we only had two COVID deaths across Canada. So, you know, nobody under the age of 20. So actually, no one in that age group needs these COVID shots. And so our purpose was to get out there and try to give a balanced approach and back everything up with science. We showed the papers and so on, to give people something to make their decisions by.
How has the response been from people following your tour? Are people waking up?
Well, I think people are waking up, because they're seeing the absurdity of the public health measures in British Columbia, which is where we did our tour. But also, you know, across Canada and around the world, we're seeing that, you know, having booster number four and booster, you know, number five, that type of thing. The people that are getting the boosters seem to be the sickest and the most hospitalized, and the increase in deaths in that age group. And yet still, you know, they're pushing this from public health. So people are starting to wake up, maybe not so much from our tour, although we did, you know, give out, we hope, lots of useful information. But they're starting to wonder themselves, I mean, how many shots you have to get when the shots are, in fact, not making them better, not protecting them. They're still being advised to wear masks on planes, et cetera. And it seems ridiculous. And I think that's what's waking people up. They're starting to have some cognitive dissonance. Everything they've been told is turning out to be not true.
Are there doctors speaking out about what they're witnessing?
Oh, yeah, there are. There are quite a few doctors who are who are out there speaking. Many of them are talking to the patients quietly in their clinics. Some are taking to, you know, the stage. And as I say, we had a group of, I think, total seven doctors who were on the tour with us at different times, you know, speaking to the community. So there are doctors who are speaking out. But, you know, the college holds a sword over all the doctors' heads, and by that I mean that if you speak out, you will certainly be investigated by the college. You'll either have, it doesn't require a complaint from the public, it could be an internal investigation, and so that's a risk for doctors, and that's one of the reasons that many of them, you know, who want to, they've worked a long time, some of them are in debt, and they all have families to feed, and for that reason many of them are concerned about, you know, being targeted by the college for an investigation. Because that could mean they would lose their license.
Your license in BC was suspended. Why?
Well, I think because I've been naughty as compared to what the college sees. And mostly, my license was suspended because I was writing exemptions for people and to not have the shots. And that's currently being investigated. So my license is still there, but it's an investigation current time. And the reason I was writing exemptions is because I felt, you know, at the basis of any medical treatment, people should have informed consent. I didn't think that was possible, particularly since we have an experimental a COVID shot, which, you know, we don't even really know the ingredients for yet. And the other one is people should not be coerced into having a medical procedure of any type. They should do that on their own free will. Now, there's excuse that we have emergency here, so we all have to do what we're told. But I think there's real doubts about whether we did have an emergency. In fact, when you look at the all-cause mortality, that's the death rate for the year 2020, which was the height of the pandemic, we really didn't have any increased deaths that year than it had in the previous years. So it'd be pretty hard to even show that we'd had a pandemic, which typically is characterized by increased deaths around the world. So, That's the story. It's and the college is, as I say, is investigating, you know, doctors when they step out of line.
As the vaccine trial data is being released, the data is revealing a staggering number of possible adverse side effects as well as deaths, yet they're still being promoted as safe and effective. Are you hearing about significant safety issues with these vaccines?
Oh yeah, when they just recently had the dumps from Pfizer, which meant that, you know, Pfizer tried to get it so they could keep their data hidden for 75 years. But the courts overruled that, and they've had to present them within a year's time. And so some of the material that we've gotten was really quite surprising. One is they had 9 pages of adverse events. Now, I'm not talking about 9 pages, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 down the page. We're talking about these back-to-back condensed. The pages are so covered with adverse events that essentially they cover pretty much everything that's in the Merck manual for medicine, and many of these were not, you know, highlighted for doctors and so forth. You know, everybody thought, oh well, it's just going to be a sore arm and maybe a bit of fever, and you might not be feeling a little bit tired for a day. But this, of course, is not what's happening. And if you go to the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, known as VAERS in the United States, which really reports only 0.8% of vaccine injuries, you can see that the number of deaths is. You know, more than the previous 30 years were reported on all vaccines. And we're seeing myocarditis and many, many different, illnesses, side effects that, you know, we never expected and never saw in other vaccines. So, there's a lot of problems with these shots. That's why I'm not recommending them.
What are you hearing on shedding and transmission of the experimental injections from the vaccinated to other people?
That's a good question. This term shedding or transmission, because there's, you know, depends. We don't really know the mechanism of it. When Pfizer did their research for their shot, the COVID shot, they did put in a section about this. In other words, to report any adverse, any symptoms that someone who was not had the shot, but was associated with someone who had the shot, particularly if they were pregnant, that those things should be reported. So obviously they were thinking even way back then that there was a risk of shedding, that people who came into contact with someone who'd had the jab, the COVID jab, would could develop symptoms. Now, around the world, that's been reported just so many times that there's no doubt that there is this phenomenon called shedding, but we don't know the mechanism. It could be that people who've had the shot are letting go of spike proteins off their skin or in their breath. That's a possibility. There is some also talk of whether people are setting up a electromagnetic field or some type, some kind of emission, and that could be what's triggering it, because we see that sometimes the symptoms that the unvaxxed person who comes in contact with a vaccinated person experiences are often, they can either be unusual bleeding, particularly in the female genital tract, so heavy periods, cramping, people who are past menopause having bleeding, children who haven't started having their periods yet started having vaginal bleeding, strange things like that, bruising. And but we also see another category where people actually feel almost like they've been irradiated, like you might expect with radiation sickness, where the symptoms are different. So it's really hard to know the mechanism. There haven't been any studies that I've seen, but there seems little doubt from a clinical perspective and the experience of many doctors and around the world that the shedding phenomenon is a real thing.
Have you had any reports of people experiencing what might be described as mental fog after getting the COVID shots?
There's so many things that have been listed as adverse effects, but we can divide them up into, pretty much cardiac, and neurologic, and then they're also, so in other words, people have brain fog, but they also have a lot of other neurological symptoms. There's cardiac symptoms as well, but also we're seeing an increase in cancers. It seems that people who've had cancer tend to be having who might be in remission or way back they had it, they tend to be having relapses, and they're seeing that these cancers then become very aggressive. And Dr. Ryan Cole has been reporting this down in the United States. So he was, I think, the first person to notice it. But also the Department of Defense in the United States is reporting this as well. And so there's lots of things happening. There's no real system in the body that's not been affected by these COVID shots in an adverse way. And then you have to weigh that against the benefits. And in my calculation, the risks far outweigh the benefits in just about every age group.
And I'm sure cancer patients were really strongly urged to get the shots, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, the idea that vaccines protect you. Well, we know this is not a vaccine, right? But we use that term. In fact, I think we're using it out of convenience, and because we've heard it said so many times in the media. But this is not really a vaccine. A vaccine is supposed to protect you against getting the disease, not just reduce your symptoms. That's the definition of a vaccine is being changed periodically by the WHO, the CDC, so that people don't expect much from it. And also they can put other things under the category. But this is not really a true vaccine. But yeah, the people that have, that are vulnerable were supposed to be protected by these shots. And so they were the ones that, for whom it was recommended, right off the bat. But, what we're seeing is the vulnerable are more likely to have adverse effects from the shots.
Is the ongoing variant narrative a way to scare people to increase the uptake of the boosters?
Yeah, when we see the Omicron variants and their subvariants, we see that they may have spread more easily among the population, but they're less dangerous. They have fewer symptoms. That's kind of the way viruses go. They become less harmful over time. And once they spread through the community, they provide what's known as herd immunity. That means, if you have 60 to 70% of people who have the infection, then it's hard for the virus to have to jump anywhere, because let's say I had it, then the virus in all my family had it, then it can't go anywhere and it essentially dies out. So that's the idea of herd immunity. But yeah, I mean, a lot of people looked at Omicron, the most current strain, and seeing that that was probably their way out of this so-called pandemic. But it's quite likely we had herd immunity long before that. And what we're seeing now is a bit of a case-demic and fear-mongering from our government sources, but also and through the media.
Is there a cumulative effect of damage to the body with each additional experimental injection?
Yes, there is. We see that there are a couple of things there. One is, yes, every time you get something which is essentially a poison, You know, you get worse each time you get the dose. And most of the adverse events, things like myocarditis, as an example, occurred after the second shot, not the first shot. But it, with coronavirus, there's this phenomenon called pathogenic priming, also known as antibody-dependent enhancement. And this means something that we've seen, which is peculiar to coronavirus and other ones, such as respiratory syncytial virus, in that the first exposure, it's kind of like a bee sting, you know, not much happens. But the second exposure causes the immune system reaction or overreaction, which causes the inflammation and so on. And that's, and that in a bee sting, that's when you get the swelling and the redness and the stinging, burning pain. And so that's kind of similar to these coronaviruses, and also, and therefore similar to the shots, is that the second shot or the third or the fourth is more likely to cause a reaction because your system has been primed by the preceding ones. And we're seeing that's true as we go along, that people, the more shots they've had, it seems to be that the more common are the adverse events, but also there's a suppression of the people's immune system. And we're seeing that in English studies coming out of the UK, that where people who've had, you know, two shots or more are actually having a reduction in their immune system's function, which means that they're more susceptible not just to coronaviruses, but also to other similar type of viruses. Essentially, it's creating a almost a vaccine type of AIDS where their immune system is being suppressed.
Are there any tests, blood or other tests, that could indicate there's damage happening from the experimental injections?
Well, if we look at blood work, you know, the D-dimer test was a good one. Now, D-dimer is a blood test which shows that there's a clotting going on somewhere in your blood, in your system. And that was a very good one because people might have had no symptoms, but they're having microscopic clotting in some place, and we don't know where it is. Now, if someone had a clot in their leg and a swollen leg, and we did a D-dimer and it was elevated, we'd have a good reason for it being like that. But now when we see elevated D-dimers, and Dr. Hoff did, looking at his patients, found that a little over 50% of the patients without symptoms had elevated D-dimers. It means they had microclotting somewhere. And that microclotting is almost certainly being caused by spike proteins. So that's one test which is very valuable, even for people that aren't having symptoms, so a D-dimer. Now, the other things you can look at is some of the cardiac enzymes. You can look at troponins, for example, something that we would do with people who had a heart attack coming into the hospital or chest pain, troponin test. And what they found is when they look at troponins, they see that a lot of people have myocardial, which is a heart enzyme, myocardial inflammation or injury causing a rise in troponins, and yet they have no symptoms. So I suspect that the incidence of myocarditis is actually much higher than what you would think just from the people who come into the hospital with symptoms. In other words, people may have mild symptoms and sort of brush it off, or may have no symptoms at all and still be having some injury there. Now, and then the ultimate test, of course, is doing an autopsy on someone who's died after the shot, and we have, you know, pretty good evidence there that looking at the microscopic slides of blood vessels in people who died shortly after the COVID shot, you see all sorts of the staining of spike proteins on the insides of people's blood vessels, which indicates that, you know, the vessels are damaged, they're leading to clotting, they're also attracting lymphocytes and other elements of inflammation. So, yeah, we've got lots of evidence that these COVID shots, lots of good objective evidence these COVID shots are harmful.
Can the experimental injection damage be reversed? Are there any regimens or protocols that might help mitigate the adverse effects of the injections?
Well, yes, there are some protocols. And in fact, in the United States, the Frontline Critical Care Consortium just came out with it's called iRecover. It's to do with people who've had the shots and have had adverse effects. The Canadian COVID Care Alliance, that's CanadianCOVIDCareAlliance.org, has also come out with a protocol. Vaccine Choice Canada also has a protocol posted on their website. So there are lots of places people can go, and there are aspects of this, you know, can be anything from ivermectin to pine needle tea for the serumen that's in that. So there are quite a few things. I usually recommend people be very careful about exposure to EMF, that electromagnetic fields. That would be, you know, your Wi-Fi, headphones sending electric currents across your head, things like that. Because there was evidence, particularly from a case study done in Luxembourg about this magnetism, and which everybody has seen. I've seen it in person on people and so forth, and there's lots of evidence that magnetism occurs after the shots. But if you think about it, you wouldn't want to be creating electric fields across your body in any particular place, particularly if it was going to draw material from the shot to that location. So I usually tell people stop putting on headphones and take out those earbuds and turn your Wi-Fi off at night and try to keep away from electromagnetic field sources. That's just a little added extra there. But the rest of the material, such as what you can do such in terms of medication, those can be found on those sites I just mentioned.
For people who have taken the jabs and have developed health issues, including heart, stroke, cancer, and autoimmune diseases, do you think they need to focus on mitigating the jabs along with treating the health issues?
Oh, yeah, I think they do. And that goes to you know, the ideas of microclotting and so forth. I mean, how you do it, that's the challenge, right? And particularly if you have a weakened area, it seems that inflammation occurs just about in every organ system of the body after these shots. And it seems to accelerate people's own inflammation. So let's say you had arthritis, it might cause your arthritis to flare up, or that you had heart disease, it might cause that to take a step forward. If you have lung disease or, you know, circulatory problems, you know, all those things appear to be aggravated. And if you look at the long list that we're getting got from Pfizer of the adverse events that they were watching, those of what they called adverse events of interest, then you see that it can affect any system in the body. So yeah, people are going to have to figure out what to do to stop it. And I think the first thing is to don't take any more shots. You don't go for that booster that's being pushed upon you. You know, stand up and say, I'm not going to do it anymore.
Is there any help available for the thousands of vaccine injured with treatments or government compensation?
Well, Canada does have a compensation program, but it's not being utilized, and it's certainly not well known. My last look, there were less than five people cases that were in review. As far as I know, no one had been paid out at that time. So there is that possibility of applying to the government, but it's yeah. So I would say you should go there. It's much harder. You cannot sue the drug companies, the ones that make the shots, the manufacturers of these COVID jabs. You can't sue them. They're protected. So you pretty much have to go get the citizens of your country to pay taxes to help you out.
We'll have more with Dr. Stephen Malthouse right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Dr. Stephen Malthouse. Stephen, there seems to be a lot of people dying suddenly, and I've noticed it seems to be soccer players who couldn't be more fit, I would think. Could there be a connection since the rollout of the jabs?
Well, certainly there's a, we're seeing, you mentioned sports, and we're seeing, you know, hundreds of people, young people who are in the top condition of around the planet dropping. Probably from cardiac arrhythmias or, you know, heart stoppage, that type of thing. We're seeing people fall over on the dais type of thing when they're speaking at programs. And so healthy people are dropping like flies. And the temporal association with these shots suggests that that's in my opinion, most likely to be the cause. So, yeah, and when we look at the deaths reported to VAERS, we see that within, you know, 50% of them are reported within the first week of having had the shot. And in fact, the first 2 days after the shot are the most dangerous from the perspective of reported deaths. So, I don't think there's much doubt that people are, you know, are dying from these shots. I know locally we find, you know, people are being found sitting in their chair or in their garden, you know, people that may have been elderly, but a lot of people that were not, that were in, you know, middle age. And people, I think if people are older, they say, well, they were old, they just, you know, died naturally. But when you get enough of those, you start to, you know, your antennas start to twitch that this is something is suspect here. And, you know, the CDC and should have been investigating this, but they don't seem to be doing their job. When we see that there have been more deaths than there were for 30 years previously in shots, reported deaths on the VAERS reporting, that's the CDC's job to have a look at that. And normally they would have stopped it, you know, back at 25 people, and now we're up at above 20,000 in the United States. And that is probably, you know, estimates are anywhere from 1% to of the actual real life deaths have been reported there. So I mean, this is, I don't know what you can say. It seems like it's a kill shot from the perspective of the number of people that are dying afterwards.
The BC CDC keeps releasing updated COVID stats, and week in, week out, 80+% of hospitalized and 90+% of deaths are people who are vaccinated. Is this now a pandemic of the vaccinated?
Yes, it is. You know, you have to compare. So when you look at the hospitals, in the beginning, when there weren't many people being given the shot, you know, the vast majority of people in the hospital were the unvaccinated because, you know, no one had had the shot, particularly certain age groups. But as time has gone on now, we're starting to see that that is changing over, and it's changing over because, again, more people have had the jabs in all these different age groups, and they're starting to get sick and go to the hospital. The other thing is the definition of vaccinated may be that not just you have one shot, but you have to have, and not just two shots, but you have two shots plus 14 days. So it means that if you had the shot and you had a, you know, a heart attack within, you know, 2 days of the shot, you went to the hospital, you would be considered unvaccinated. So that's another way that they skewed the results there. But right now, even using the idea that, you know, vaccinated plus 14 days, it makes you a fully vaccinated person and therefore get onto the vax list in the hospital if they ask you, because a lot of times they're not asking whether you're vaxxed or not. But what we're seeing now is that the vaccinated people, the COVID shot people, are starting to have exceeded in terms of percentage of the population, their particular population. So as a percentage of the vaxxed compared to a percentage of the unvaxxed, that they're now exceeding it. So yes, this is a pandemic of the vaccinated. And I don't think we've seen anything yet. There's a lot more to come here.
We've heard this upcoming winter could be devastating. Could we be in for a significant die-off?
Well, I don't know if die-off is the right term there, but you know, in the winter we generally have more deaths. I suspect they're going to roll out a few more boosters and maybe even try to get people to have smallpox vaccinations or monkeypox vaccinations, you know, and what might be considered high risk groups. I would not be surprised about that. But, you know, the winter brings its own increased mortality, and a lot of that may be prevented by people with taking proper nutrition. And in Canada, people do need to take vitamin D in adequate doses and have their blood test to make sure that is adequate, to get themselves up in the top range of the range, which is, you know, 100 to 150 nanomoles per liter. And so a blood test is really important. But I usually recommend for my patients, unless there's any contraindication, to take 4,000 international units of vitamin D a day throughout the winter, usually starting in late October, because the sun is not in a position to be able to give them the vitamin D they need. So I think that people can do something to mitigate that, but seeing how the agenda has been rolled out in the last couple of years, I suspect we will have more deaths, excessive number of deaths probably come fall.
Does the experimental injection have an effect on the immune system, and are there ways to boost the immune system?
Well, yes, we're seeing that people are becoming more susceptible to getting COVID themselves, but also other illnesses. We're seeing that, you know, the immune system is very important for protecting against cancers. Your immune system clears up abnormal cells. And so if you interfere with the immune system, you're going to have a jump in cancers. You're going to have an increase in infections and so on, and we're seeing that. So, and the evidence is that we have more hospitalizations among people that have had the jabs. So, there seems to be little doubt that the immune system is being affected. And what that will mean from the perspective of other infectious diseases coming this winter, we'll have to wait and see, but suspect that it will make people more vulnerable.
Do face masks decrease oxygen levels along with causing other health issues?
I think we've known for a long time that face masks don't work when you have an aerosolized virus, which is, you know, 0.1 microns in size. And, you know, it can go, not only goes right through masks, but it can go out the sides and all around the place. It can be suspended in the air for, in some studies, at least 2 days, and it can, you know, travel 28 feet in distance. So, I mean, that's just one study. But this thought that it can remain along for a long time in the airs around you. So face masks never did work. And in fact, I think face masks were just a form of showing your compliance more than anything else. But from the perspective of being harmful, yes, they're extremely harmful. Not only do they drop oxygen levels and increase your carbon dioxide levels, the carbon dioxide levels go up so high that if you were in a workspace, an industrial site, you would be evacuated because of the danger, and that would be an immediate evacuation. But that's the level that we're seeing the carbon dioxide go up, and that's why people get headaches and, you know, don't feel well after they've been wearing a mask for a couple of hours. They also create a petri dish in front of your face, so stuff that you normally breathe out, you know, bacteria, et cetera, collect on the mask. And then you're kind of breathing it back in. Plus, masks shred, and little tiny bits of material are going down to lungs, about the size of asbestos. And so we're going to see lung problems from the material from masks, which will take a little bit of time to come to the fore. Other problems, of course, psychological problems. You know, kids in not being able to see faces and so forth, and that's so important for learning. And you may have noticed that the CDC has changed the developmental milestones and set them all back 6 months for various reasons, but I'm sure they're due to the public health policies that have been rolled out, and it's inhibited children's ability to learn and to develop normally, and so they've kind of, you know, made room for that by pushing the measurements back, and rather than getting at the cause, which is, you know, wearing masks and, you know, frightening parents and children across the board. So, masks have lots of health issues. If you were deaf, you wouldn't be able to hear people speak, and very easily you might get the incorrect instructions from your family doctor on how to take a pill because you can't hear them speaking. There's so many things. It's kind of funny that you go into a bank nowadays, and you know, the only people that are criticized by fellow customers and the bank people are those that are not wearing masks. That's kind of a turnaround.
Now, I recall last time we talked, you saw an increase in eye infections in your patients who are wearing face masks. I know I got one because face masks were mandatory. Other people mentioned the same thing, too. They'd never had a problem with their eyes before, but they were getting infections. Is that because of the nasty stuff blowing up from the mask?
Yeah, exactly. So not only is it directing the air up to your eyes, right, and there's another issue, fog glasses and people tripping and falling, breaking their hips, that type of thing is all a possibility. But when you have a Petri dish, which is, those dishes we grow bacteria in the hospital, if you have that sitting in front of your face, and, you know, they've done some studies where they've actually did a beautiful study with kids taking their mask and then culturing them, and they found incredible numbers of bacteria, some not very nice bacteria either, in those masks. But if you're blowing that up around your eyes all day long, you can imagine the increased risk for getting eye infections. But we've also seen increased sinus infections, increased brain infections, and also what's called mask mouth, which is something dentists are reporting, where people are having more infections of their gums and teeth. So, what's good about masks? You know, in the hospital, when we wear masks, it's to prevent splatter. And so it's a bit like protecting the surgeon from the splatter from the wound of the patient. And they have done studies where they've had surgeons not wearing masks and then alternating wearing masks, not wearing masks. And they found that the wound infections actually decreased when the surgeons did not wear the masks. And there are surgeons that when they wear masks, they get tremors and so forth, even though they have, you know, high oxygen and good airflow in the surgical rooms. So, you know, even in surgery, people don't wear masks to prevent wound infections because it can't do that. I mean, of course, you don't want to spit or your nose to run down into a wound, but that's pretty uncommon and rare. But the idea is really if you're having wound stuff from the wound, either a spray or splatter or something like that, it doesn't come up and go into your face when you're a surgeon.
Rapid tests are being given away in schools and pharmacies and other places where constant testing is being encouraged. Are there potential dangers in testing and repeated testing?
Well, if the test is not reliable, then it gives you either a false sense of security or a false sense of you know, that you're in danger. And that's the problem with these tests. The PCR test, of course, is classic for that, in that at least 90% of the positive tests were false positives. based on the number of cycles they were doing with it. That means how many times they amplified the material from the person's nose to try to get a positive test. They're amplifying it, 35 to 45 times across the country when they should have been amplifying at maximum probably 35, but more often it would be set at 25 repetitions. But with the rapid antigen ones, they were giving those out like candy. Even people, I heard a story of someone who got one from the grocery store as like a gift when they bought their groceries. And they were handing them out to kids, and people were taking, their $50 each, those packs, and they were taking one, five packs home. And they were trying out their dog, taking tests of their dog's genitals and sending those in and things. And, so that type of, and then also the ingredients, the solutions that are in there are toxic, poisonous. And we're giving these out to little kids to take home to their families, and so there were recalls on them, but of course everybody had them in their hands, and I'm sure that the number that were recalled were pretty small. So yeah, is it an advantage? Well, if it can't tell you that you actually have it or don't have it, so it's unreliable testing, and secondly, the products themselves are dangerous. So what's good about rapid testing? The other one is it's making hypochondriacs people. They're testing themselves five times a day. Because they have a cold or a bit of an allergy. And so that's kind of, again, propagating the fear and I think also pushing the narrative that everything that causes you to sneeze is COVID.
If people do get COVID, are there best early treatment protocols, and is there a website people can go to for guidance?
Absolutely. Well, there have been early treatments for COVID which have been successful. Using hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, inhaled steroids, budesonide. They've used chlorine dioxide in Central America and South America very successfully. And, there's so many ways to catch it early when it's in the viral stage. As it goes beyond that, some people get worse, then they have to start treating it more aggressively with things like steroids and anticoagulants and so forth. And ivermectin has been wonderful. If people had used ivermectin, the evidence is very clear that places, for example, in India that use ivermectin, their incidence of disease dropped precipitously down to, practically zero. So ivermectin could have estimates are between 70 and 80% of deaths could have been prevented just with ivermectin alone, and that's only one of the many types of early treatment. In British Columbia, doctors were prevented from using ivermectin. In fact, we get into trouble with our college after October 1st, 2021, if we prescribe ivermectin for any patients.
Since the government decided to mandate vaccinations on numerous employment sectors, we're hearing of several lawsuits against Provincial Chief Health Officer Dr. Bonnie Henry and BC Premier John Horgan and others. Do you know how these lawsuits are going?
Well, I think that there's a bit of a change here, maybe a bit of a sea change in that, Bonnie Henry and her colleagues in other provinces, aren't unable to kind of slip the legal noose by, taking a holiday during the time they should be in court or, saying that it's an emergency, so they had to do it. And, the science is changing, so, their decisions couldn't be black and white. And, so I think we're seeing some changes there. And, the evidence does not support anything that Bonnie Henry has done in the last couple of years, and it's pretty clear. Nevertheless, she's still pushing vaccines, and now they're trying to get it down into kids, right? Moderna is applying for to have the shots moved down to the six-month-old to infants, when it's obvious that they have no risks from COVID from the perspective of death or even severe illness. It's very, very small, and there are lots of ways we could treat before having to resort to vaccines. So I, for one, I'm glad that we're finally getting the truth out there and the courts are starting to listen rather than dismissing it as, something they don't really know much about, and they just allow the CDC to make their decisions for them. Because we're learning that a lot of these experts are not to be relied upon it anymore. That's one of the big lessons we've learned here. The CDC, the FDA, the WHO, and all their minions down below them are no longer trustworthy. And the evidence is that is very clear. We've known that the COVID shots and the public policies that have been rolled out have been harmful for some time. We've seen so many deaths from overdoses and addiction and alcoholism and et cetera that We know that these things all should have been included in the pandemic plan, which in fact they had, but they did not follow it. They threw out Dr. Tam, Dr. Henry, who worked on the pandemic plan years ago, essentially chucked it out the window and made up their own agenda, which has been nothing but harmful.
Even with the lawsuits, there's been no backing down from either the federal or provincial governments on the push for mass vaccination, even though the injections are experimental. How do you stop this possible genocide?
Well, they're really the only way we're going to stop it. We have to put pressure in every way. So from the perspective of legal cases, that needs to be done, and writing to the government needs to be done. And I would recommend people become members of the Conservative Party just so they can help vote someone in there who knows what's happening, is defending the rights of the citizens. But the way we're going to stop this is united noncompliance, peaceful united noncompliance. And that means that, we just have to say, no, I'm not going to do that. We have to stand up and draw a line, particularly when it comes to our children. We need to say, look, we're not going to give our kids those shots. They're dangerous, they have no benefit, and they're not needed. And parents have to step up to the plate and defend their kids. I mean, that's our job, right? So that's where we're going to stop it. We're going to say no. And, we can't rely on the nanny state to take care of us anymore. We're learning that we have to grow up and take responsibility ourselves and say, look, you're not going to put that thing in my arm, and that's all it is. Now, you can try to force me, you can imprison me, you can take away my job, etc. I know that's hard for people to do, because some people do have to feed their families, and that's understandable. So this is not a black and white case, but that's the way we're going to stop it, is people going to say, no more, I'm not taking it, and stand up for themselves.
The COVID and vaccine narratives have greatly divided society. Is this mass psychosis, and how can people get back together and heal?
Yeah, well, divide and conquer has always been the way of winning, right, when you're fighting an enemy. And we're seeing the divisions here, not just the vax versus the unvax, but there's other divisions that's going on as well. And we have to really prevent that from happening, or at least to bring our wounded society back together, because I think that division is already there. It's been created intentionally, and that way we get our neighbors to police neighbors. This was done, in Germany before, during the Nazi regime. And so we have to really see through history that this is the way it's done, divide and conquer. And, mass formation or mass formation psychosis, this is a term which means that when there are four elements of present in society, such as isolation and anxiety and lack of direction, when those things are present, then that society is ripe for a takeover by tyrannical overlords. And we've had that in our society, and that's why we were so easily brainwashed into following this agenda. So how to get back together? Well, we all have to make efforts to discover what is it in us that differs from artificial intelligence and computers, and what is human nature really. And I think when we discover that, then we'll realize how much we have in common with people who may not be of the same opinion as ourselves, and then we'll be able to open dialogue and stop censoring people. Even on my little island here on Denman Island, in our newspaper, we have people calling out for censorship of other people, and that is a reflection of the division that's been created, that we won't let people speak their minds if their opinions don't agree with ours, and we've got to stop that. We've got to let people have their opinions. That's their sovereignty, and when we do that, when we're more forgiving, more sort of adaptable, more forgiving, and in some ways have more gratitude for this debate that we can have, which can help make things move forward, right? In medicine, we haven't had much debate because everything's been censored. If we'd had debate and discussion in the early days, we wouldn't be where we are today with people dying so easily and taking these shots when they're not necessary. So that's the way to get out of it. One other way people get out of mass formation psychosis is they see the absurdity of what they're doing and that they're heading towards a cliff. People like to go into the center of a herd. That's the way it's the most safe. And when they start to see that the herd is running to the cliff, as we can obviously see that what's happening here with these shots and all the propaganda we're getting from the television set, and our governments, and the WHO is trying to take over the sovereignty of all the countries for themselves with their treaty, which is coming up. People should be aware of that, that the WHO wants to make a pandemic treaty to try to, whether we have a reason for it or not, a pandemic or even a suspected pandemic, that the WHO can then start dictating legally to the countries and telling them what to do. So they could have you masking up and getting your shots, you know, in their home bases someplace in Geneva and telling Canadians what to do. So, you know, we need to be aware of that we're running towards a cliff edge and to decide that we're going to leave the herd and get out. There's another herd not too far away, which seems to be going in the right direction, and people should join that one.
Where can people find out more about the Canada Health Alliance?
Oh, that's good. The Canada Health Alliance. You know, the Canada Health Alliance, I think, is going to become a major player in trying to move the paradigm into something in the future which is better for people, better for patients, better for clients, et cetera, because we're going to try to bring in all the different types of medicine that could be, that are not in the mainstream these days, and break down those silos. You know, doctors don't talk to chiropractors, and doctors don't talk to naturopaths, and so on, and that really can't be if we're going to have, bring in all the therapies which can be potentially beneficial for people. And I tell you, with what we're seeing with these COVID shots, we need as many therapies to help people out as we can get. But the future of medicine cannot be big pharma driven. It can't be pharmaceutically based. We're not going to throw everything out, the baby with the bathwater, because there are some good drugs, and surgery and emergency work is fantastic when necessary. But we haven't accessed many of these things like Chinese medicine, homeopathy, orthomolecular medicine, functional medicine. There's just so many other therapies out there that people are not aware of because they're relying upon their doctor to give them direction. So we need to break down those silos, and that's what Canada Health Alliance is all about. It's envisioning and then moving us towards a new paradigm, probably more based on terrain theory rather than the germ theory. In other words, everything doesn't come as a germ from the outside, but it's a lot to do with your susceptibility, your ability to fight off germs is important, and other health issues. So that's Canada Health Alliance in a nutshell. And if the people go to Canada Health Alliance, not Canadian, but CanadaHealthAlliance.org, that's the website for the association, and there's a great library there. There's where people can access a lot of information about the whole the COVID material, and that research is very reliable, and and they can join up. Whether they're if they're a healthcare professional, they'll join, and if they're a not but are interested in health, they can join as what's known as health angels. This is a group of volunteers who aren't necessarily practitioners, but feel that they want to put their effort into improving healthcare in Canada.
British Columbia has a severe family doctor shortage. A million people, about 20% of the population, doesn't have a family doctor. What caused this problem and what's the cure?
It's a many-faceted problem. It's not just due to money, although I think that family doctors could be paid better. That would take some of the stress off them. But there's been a move. There's been a couple of things here that have caused that. One is in medical schools, they told the students if they want to become a surgeon, they can't do family practice first and then a few years later become a surgeon when they decide that's what they really like. So they have to decide early on in their medical school where they want to go, and then they have to start making if they ever want to be a surgeon, they have to then start, you know, going and doing extra surgical stuff and so forth. And so they have to make decisions very early in their career. And for that reason, you know, they're opting for specialties which are more attractive. In the old days, you know, a lot of people did, when I was an intern, you know, we did a regular rotation, and then we went into medicine, into family practice, and then we may have decided later, hey, I want to be an obstetrician and go back and get retraining. But there's no room for that nowadays. So that's one thing. So there's a fault in the way kids are brought through the medical schools. The other one is that when and I'm speaking just from my experience as a physician for 43 years, is that regular medicine is a bit like a revolving door. We never really cure the chronic diseases. We put a Band-Aid on them. We may relieve symptoms, and that's not necessarily bad, but it doesn't go to deep healing. And so people have to come back because either having a side effect from the drug they were given, or their illness does not get better. And so it's kind of like a revolving door that people, and that's why doctors are so busy, because they're not curing anybody. That's my feel about it. And Also, you know, doctors are being discouraged because if you don't see the miraculous in the practice of medicine, others see people really cured where they had, you know, migraine headaches all their life and then they no longer have them, or, you know, something that they've been plagued with as a chronic disease for so long and it disappears because of your treatment. When you don't see that miraculous in medicine, then it can, over time, that wears doctors down and they start to look for secondary reinforcers such as money. And so that's part of it. Now the other one is, as you say, that we can't find family doctors, and you know, a lot of people who have not had the double shots or have been let go from the hospitals, and that just, you know, worsened the problem. And yet we know that these shots, these COVID shots, cannot prevent transmission, and they do not reduce the severity of the disease. In fact, the opposite. So there was no sense in firing these people because they were not a danger to anybody, and they were not a danger to the healthcare system. And yet they were fired, which now means we have all these the problems with not just not having a family physician, but also the hospitals are not well staffed. They're having to shut wards, close them temporarily, and some aren't even, you know, are closed permanently in different hospitals across the country. But you know, doctors are going to be stressed out. It's been a pretty tough year. There's been a lot of stress that doctors are receiving because of the whole COVID thing, whether they're caught up with the narrative and belief that, you know, COVID is a pandemic that they have to wear a mask every day to the office for, or whether, you know, their colleagues are essentially ostracizing them because, you know, they're not double jabbed, and they think that the pandemic did not really occur and that the public health measures are harmful. You know, it's a stressful environment for doctors nowadays, for family doctors. So we never had enough, and doctors are leaving either early retirement, or they're just, you know, taking jobs as something which is easier, like a hospitalist perhaps, something like that. So that's why we can't find a GP. Many people can't find a GP here, and walk-in clinics are also closing. You know, they haven't got people to staff them. They're just finding it's not financially feasible in their eyes, and so more and more of the possibilities for patients are disappearing. I've heard that people, you know, line up by 8:30 in the morning. They've lined up for the walk-in clinics, and the nurse comes out and tells them, "We're full up for the day. Go home." At 8:30 in the morning. And now, if you were an elderly person with no doctor, you would find that very difficult. You know, get up early, go and line up outside of a walk-in clinic, and then be told go home because there are no more spaces available by 8:30. So yeah, we're in pretty tough times here. The squeeze is on, but you know, hopefully something, because of that squeeze, that pressure will have some developments occur that will revolutionize and save medicine.
So, Steve, it's the Canadian Health Alliance?
It's a Canada Health Alliance, okay. Yeah. People make a mistake. It's not Canadian, although it is Canadian, but the title is the Canada Health Alliance, and the website is CanadaHealthAlliance.org.
Stephen, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thanks, Jim. It's been a pleasure.
We've been speaking with Dr. Stephen Malthouse, president of the Canada Health Alliance, online at CanadaHealthAlliance.org. He was speaking to us from Denman Island, British Columbia. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on the Goddard Report and TalkDigitalNetwork.com are an expression of opinion only. The Goddard Report is available online and mobile at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. The Goddard Report is a production of How Street Media Incorporated.